U.S. Democratic candidate Joe Biden maintains the lead in Pennsylvania, Georgia, and Nevada, inching closer to presidency as incumbent Donald Trump has turned to courts to challenge the votes. Iran's foreign minister, in a meeting with his Cuban counterpart, says Tehran and Havana have stood together in the face of U.S., quote, economic terrorism. Also ahead, the European Union is set to impose tariffs on $4 billion of U.S. imports in retaliation for Washington's subsidies for plane maker Boeing. Welcome to World News. We're live from our headquarters in the reigning capital, Tehran. Our top story, Democratic candidate Joe Biden inches closer to victory in the U.S. presidential election as President Donald Trump turns to the courts to challenge the results. Biden is leading Trump in the key states of Arizona, Georgia, Nevada, and Pennsylvania, while the president is ahead in Alaska and North Carolina. The race is particularly tight in Georgia, where Biden's lead over Trump is in the hundreds. Biden has so far secured 264 out of the 270 electoral votes he needs to become president, while Trump has obtained 214. The Trump campaign has filed several lawsuits with the states to complain about voting irregularities and call for a halt to ballot counting. Biden and his supporters, however, say every vote must be counted. In Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, people gathered outside a ballot counting center celebrating in anticipation of Biden's potential victory. A similar rally was also held outside the White House in Maricopa County, Arizona, the state where Biden still holds a lead. Armed Trump supporters protested the results outside an election center. They reiterated Trump's allegation that Democrats were rigging the votes. Ramin Mazahari is our correspondent in Chicago, and he joins us now. Ramin, welcome. How close are we to seeing these handful of swing states swinging in the direction of a presidential candidate?
I would say we're not close at all. I mean, we have to keep in mind that the mainstream media, which has been so anti-Trump, I think any objective journalist would say, we have to keep in mind that they're now totally anti-Trump during this election. And the reality is that the United States has drastically changed the rules for their election this year because of the pandemic. You know, back in March, it seemed to make sense to have a lot of mail-in ballots, but we've had dozens of countries with successful elections this year, but the U.S. continued this. And this is something that we cannot deny that half the country perhaps is not happy with. So there's going to be serious litigations going on because this is an election unlike any other in terms of how it's been, how they have voted and how they are counting. So we have to keep in mind that when we listen to the mainstream media, they're doing everything they can as they've done for 4 years. You know, I have no dog in the fight, Biden or Trump, but it's clear that for 4 years, they have done everything they could to push Trump out. So they are systematically suppressing the pro-Trump vote, which is voters, which is, you know, half the country, which is over 70 million people. So when you listen to pro-Trump media, they are absolutely incensed about, what's going on and all of these irregularities. So, it's something that you have to seek out because the mainstream media is corporate dominated and they're so obviously anti-Trump. But when you listen to really the pulse of the, pro-Trumper movement, that is really only found on AM talk radio. That's just the way it is, and in local, very local newspapers. So when you look at these sources, which reflect, half the country, they paint a very, very different picture, and they are absolutely gearing up for legal battle. I wouldn't say actual battle, not at all in the slightest. They feel, these types of media, they will get right-wing professors, right-wing lawyers, right-wing thinkers to analyze the situation from their point of view, and they're not happy at all. So there's not any chance, in my opinion, that they're going to just throw in the towel as Al Gore did in 2000. Or Al Gore said it was for the good of the nation. Donald Trump doesn't really do anything for the good of the nation more than he does it for the good of himself. So when you add, you know, this Trump factor into the mix, I don't think it's going to be decided anytime soon. However, the mainstream media is acting it's going to happen at any moment. And in fact, Joe Biden said earlier today he was going to address the nation in prime time. And the Washington Post reported that he said he's not going to wait until all the votes are counted before declaring victory. That's a huge problem. You know, it's why is it a problem when Trump declares victory prematurely, but it's not a problem when Biden has made very, 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 very similar statements. That's, you know, it's this idea that Trump does it so blatantly that it's not a problem when Biden does it more subtly. My point here is that for the 70 million Trump supporters, it is a huge problem, and they have lawyers, and they do have, you know, recourse to, you know, certain medias. However, it's systematically sort of suppressed, but, you know, you can't suppress the courts here. You can't suppress, you know, 70 million Trump voters. They can't be totally wrong. So, you know, they're going to really contest this election, no matter what the New York Times says, no matter what CNN says, and that's just sort of the unreported upon reality that as an objective journalist I'm passing on because that's just my job.
Okay, great stuff. Thank you very much, Rami. Rami Mazahari, our correspondent, joining us from Chicago. Meanwhile, several prominent Republicans have rallied behind U.S. President Donald Trump over his claims that Democrats are using illegal votes in an attempt to steal the election.
I think you're going to see in the next 48 hours real evidence of systematic voting irregularities. There's a complaint filed by the U.S. Attorney to the U.S. Attorney in Michigan by someone, I think, in the post office who was told to backdate ballots instead of November the 4th. It'd be November the 3rd, so they'd be counted. Democracy.
Graham described the results in Philadelphia as crooked as a snake. Representative Kevin McCarthy, who leads the Republican minority in the House, has said the results were far from over. Senator Ted Cruz claimed that Pennsylvania's Democratic Attorney General had ordered vote counting in Philadelphia to continue until Joe Biden wins. However, other Republicans distanced themselves from Trump's claims of fraud or adopted a more balanced stance. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said every legal vote should be counted, while illegally submitted ballots must not. Trump campaign has filed lawsuits in several states, reaching out to donors to raise at least $60 million to fund legal challenges. Political commentator Margaret Kimberly says the desire to get President Donald Trump out of the office is the main reason for the huge turnout in the U.S. presidential election.
What is surprising is the fact that it's taken, this is now the third day of counting votes, but that's an indication of the huge turnout that was created, frankly, by Donald Trump and by the desire to get this man out of office. So that many of those who sat out in 2016 were moved to get to the polls in 2020. But it's interesting, Biden appears to be headed to victory. It's much more difficult for Donald Trump to get there. And that is why he is calling these lawsuits, which I believe will be futile. We're going to have a Biden presidency. But that brings with it some challenges because there's a large number of voters who just want to get rid of Trump, who have not really asked much of Biden. And he is in a position, frankly, to create huge problems in this country and around the world.
And political commentator Nedfa Freeman says the U.S. presidential election is used to misdirect the radical energy of Americans.
People have been mobilized to dislike Trump, and he's very easily dislikable But at the same time, because we're not asking for anything, there are some serious problems that the country has that will not be addressed by a Democratic presidential candidate, particularly Joe Biden. For example, the economic extreme crisis that this country is in, that's been exacerbated because of the pandemic. There is the issue of police, really rampant police brutality and extrajudicial killings that Joe Biden has promised that he wants to increase funding for the police and support the police. And so there's really no difference there. And then there's a threat of war that we don't really hear a lot about, and the media has done a good job of, if not being in line with the march to war, they definitely don't report on it. And so particularly with against Russia and China. And so these are the things that I think the public could be very well blindsided by, and that a lot of hopes have been put into the election. In fact, the uprisings that we saw right after murder of George Floyd, they have kind of been misdirected, which is how they use the electoral process a lot in this country, to misdirect the radical expressions and energies of the populace, particularly of people, non-white people.
Welcome back. Iran's foreign minister says his country and Cuba have stood together despite U.S., quote, economic terrorism.
Iran and Cuba have stood together in the face of pressure from the United States, pressure that can only be considered as economic terrorism.
Zarif made the remarks in a meeting with his Cuban counterpart, Bruno Rodriguez, in Havana. Rodriguez described the meeting as a very important occasion to boost political and economic ties between the two countries. Zarif's visit to Havana and his meeting with Cuban officials comes in line with the two nations' efforts to strengthen mutual support in the face of Washington's sanctions. Zarif visited Cuba 2 days after he arrived in Venezuela, another Latin American ally that is subject to U.S. sanctions. Elsewhere, the European Union is preparing to impose tariffs on $4 billion of U.S. products in retaliation for Washington's subsidies for aircraft maker Boeing. An EU diplomat said the tariffs will target imports including planes and plane parts and could go into effect next Tuesday or Wednesday. Many European governments have already backed the tariffs, which are expected to be put in place after a meeting of EU trade ministers on Monday. The move comes in response to U.S. tariffs on European goods over subsidies for Boeing's rival Airbus. The World Trade Organization gave the European Union the right to impose countermeasures. However, the United States has threatened to respond if the bloc chooses to impose retaliatory measures. Protests against the government's handling of the pandemic crisis have continued in Italy. Angered taxi drivers have staged two protests in Rome, calling on the executive to support their sector with subsidies. Max Civilli has more from Rome.
On Friday, taxi drivers went on a one-day strike nationwide, calling the government's attention to the economic plight they're facing following the pandemic crisis and the connected restrictions. Unions also called two protests held in front of the economy and transport ministries, attended by thousands of taxi drivers from across the country. Drivers are demanding more support from the government as, quote, they don't have the money to pay the monthly costs of the vehicles, nor to provide for their families.
Gli aiuti ricevuti sono assolutamente insufficienti.
The subsidies we have received from the government so far are totally inadequate. €275 each month is not sufficient. How are we supposed to put food on the table for our families? Consider we have suffered losses in the range of 80 to 90%.
Intorno ai 3.600 euro.
Io ho ricevuto.
My income has dropped by 80%, but all expenses have remained unvaried. Insurance fees, fuel and car disinfection costs have not been reduced. Furthermore, the government is doing nothing to stop illegal cabs from going around.
È molto alta.
A new three-tire restriction system came into force on Friday. As a result, four Italian regions, namely Calabria, Lombardy, Piedmont and Val d'Aosta, have been placed in soft lockdowns. The government has also imposed a nationwide curfew from 10 p.m. until 5 a.m., requiring all museums and galleries to shut down and all shopping centers to close on weekends.
Protests against the new anti-COVID restrictions imposed by the government have been staged in a number of cities across Italy. Some demonstrations turned violent as protesters vented their frustration and anger over how the pandemic crisis has been handled.
The virus is a moving train. Today it is necessary to slow it down, otherwise the train will knock us down. We are hopeful that these measures will be limited to several weeks.
The new restrictions imposed by the Italian government apply for about 4 weeks until December 3. Max Civili, Rome.
Elsewhere, a Palestinian in Israeli jail has ended his nearly four-month hunger strike after reaching a deal with Israel to release him. Maher al-Akhras is to be released on November the 26th. He was on hunger strike for more than 103 days in protest against Israel's so-called administrative detention policy. Akhras was arrested near the occupied West Bank city of Nablus in July. He was put in the administrative detention, a policy Israel uses to hold Palestinian suspects without a charge for an indefinite period of time. According to a Palestinian rights group, Al-Damir, out of 4,400 Palestinians in Israeli jails, 355 are currently being held under administrative detention orders. International rights groups have called Israel's policy a violation of humanitarian law. Mona Kandil says Palestinians see the release of the hunger-striking prisoner Maher al-Akhras as a great victory against the Israeli regime.
Well, for the Palestinians, this news is a victory. A Palestinian prisoner has achieved a victory. Another Palestinian prisoner on administrative detention achieves a victory in the face of the Israeli policy, the illegal administrative detention that allows the Israeli regime to keep Palestinians behind bars for a long period of time, for months and years, without charges or trials. Palestinians were happy about receiving this news. The different political powers, the Hamas resistance movement, issued a statement saying Maher al-Akhras and his hunger strike represents another example, and it's a continuation of the path of resistance to grab freedom. The jihad movement also welcomed this news and considered the battle of Maher al-Akhras as another victory in facing the illegal administrative detention. And it's an insistence also by another Palestinian prisoner to grab a freedom.
That brings an end to our news bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
A diverse range of programs. Youth. Spirituality. Culture. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
Three years ago, a military operation in Myanmar destroyed entire Rohingya Muslim villages. United Nations investigators say as many as 10,000 people were killed, and more than 730,000 Rohingya Muslims fled the massacre for neighboring Bangladesh. The United Nations called it a textbook ethnic cleansing. After fleeing a brutal crackdown which left thousands of people dead in their homeland of Myanmar, the Rohingya are once again under threat. In Cox's Bazar, the massive refugee camp in Bangladesh, to which many of the Rohingya refugees have fled, violence and drug and human trafficking are on the rise. The Bangladeshi government has begun relocating hundreds of the refugees to the small remote silt island of Basanchar. For the past 3 years, the authorities have been building a new town at a cost of $350 million. Their aim is to relocate more than 100,000 refugees in order to ease tensions within the camps. Bangladesh's Prime Minister, Sheikh Hasina, has frequently defended her government's plans, urging the international community to understand that, with over 1 million refugees living in Cox's Bazar, the escalation in violence, as well as both drug and human trafficking, shows the camps are no longer safe nor sustainable. We now present you an article written by Akbar Hossein under the heading Far From Home, Rohingya Refugees Face New Peril on a Remote Island. The article has been taken from the WNewsNetwork.com. Please stay with us for more of Akbar Hossein's article. After fleeing a brutal crackdown which left thousands of people dead in their homeland of Myanmar, the Rohingya Muslims are once again under threat. In Cox's Bazar, the massive refugee camp in neighboring Bangladesh, to which many of the Rohingya refugees have fled, violence and drug and human trafficking are on the rise. The Bangladeshi government has begun relocating hundreds of refugees against their will to the small remote silt island of Basanchar. On the first visit to the island by journalists, they went to investigate what the future holds for the tens of thousands of Rohingya Muslims still living in limbo. It's been 6 months since 55-year-old Rashida Khatun has heard from her children. Rashida Khatun and her family live in Cox's Bazar, but in February, before the coronavirus had fully taken hold in Bangladesh, two of Rashida's children set off on a perilous journey. Driven by their belief in a better future, her 17-year-old daughter and 22-year-old son boarded a small fishing vessel with 24 other Rohingya refugees and began the 10-day journey from Cox's Bazar to Malaysia. Sitting in her makeshift house of bamboo and plastic with a white headscarf draped over her head and shoulders, Rashida Khatun described how her family fled from their homeland in Myanmar in 2017 after the military attacked her village in Mongdao and burnt down her house. 3 years ago, a military operation in Myanmar destroyed entire Rohingya Muslim villages. United Nations investigators say as many as 10,000 people were killed and more than 730,000 Rohingya Muslims fled the massacre for neighboring Bangladesh. The United Nations called it a textbook ethnic cleansing operation. After years of living in temporary shelters and with no hope of returning to their ancestral homeland, Rashida Khatun's son and daughter had become desperate to escape the escalating violence and lack of opportunities in the refugee camps. So they decided to flee to the Muslim-majority country of Malaysia. Rashida Khatun said, "One of my relatives in Malaysia phoned me last year. He assured me my daughter would be able to get married there and that my son would be able to get a good job. Traveling by boat from Bangladesh to Malaysia has become the most common route out of the refugee camps for young Rohingya Muslims, but it's a treacherous journey. In the same week, Rashida Khatun's children departed, a fishing boat carrying dozens of refugees capsized just off the coast of Bangladesh. 14 people died in that incident. After 10 days at sea, Rashida Khatun's children, who we have not named to protect their safety, made it within sight of the Malaysian coastline. But they were being tracked by the Malaysian Navy. Refused permission to dock by the Malaysian authorities, their tiny fishing vessel was left stranded for a month, floating in the Andaman Sea. Eventually, Bangladesh's Coast Guard, bowing under the pressure from local media and human rights groups, intervened. Along with hundreds of other refugees who had also been refused entry to Malaysia, Rashida Khatun's children were not allowed to return home to the camps of Cox's Bazar, but were instead taken to the small island of Basanchar in the Bay of Bengal. Back in Cox's Bazar, Rashida Khatun received a call from an unknown number. Rashida Khatun says, "My daughter sounded very anxious. She was crying when she told me that she was being taken to an island named Basanchar. It was the last time she spoke to her daughter." The island of Basanchar, located 60 kilometers off the coast of Bangladesh, emerged less than 20 years ago from the sea. Situated less than 2 meters above sea level, the island is made entirely of silt, Himalayan sediment washed down river and into the sea. For the past 3 years, the authorities have been building a new town at a cost of $350 million. Their aim is to relocate more than 100,000 refugees in order to ease tensions within the refugee camps. Bangladesh's Prime Minister, Sheikh Hasina, has frequently defended her government's plans, urging the international community to understand that, with over 1 million refugees living in Cox's Bazar, the escalation in violence as well as both drug and human trafficking shows the refugee camps are no longer safe nor sustainable. She said at the United Nations General Assembly last year, "The crisis is now becoming a regional threat. Besides increasing congestion and environmental degradation, it's also challenging health and security in the area." But for many Rohingya Muslims, the island of Basanchar is closer to a prison than a refugee camp. All of the 306 refugees living on the island, including Rashida Khatun's 2 children, were relocated to the island against their will, and none are allowed to leave the island. Under pressure from the United Nations Human Rights Council to stop sending Rohingya to the island against their will, the Bangladeshi authorities are now engaging in an all-out marketing campaign to promote the island as a spacious and modern alternative to the conditions faced by those living in the refugee camps. Their efforts include taking a small pool of journalists on an exclusive media tour of the facilities, all coordinated by and under the watchful eye of the Bangladeshi Navy and intelligence services. After 3 hours' travel on board a Navy vessel, Commodore Abdullah Al-Ma'moon Chaudhry escorted the small band of journalists around the newly finished site. The newly built Basanchar town forms a giant grid with hundreds of rows of red-roofed houses. All that journalists saw stood vacant, waiting for an influx of refugees. Overhead, installed on every house and every corner, security cameras kept watch. Bangladeshi Navy officials were keen to point out two schools, a mosque, two 40-bed hospitals, and two community clinics, all currently under construction. Chaudhary said, "The infrastructure is eco-friendly," he added. "There is plenty of open space. Here they will have electricity, which they don't have in Cox's Bazar refugee camp. The most important thing is education. We have constructed schools for Rohingya children where they will get better education." Earlier this year, Amnesty International released a damning report on the conditions faced by the 306 Rohingya already living on the island of Basanchar. The report contained allegations of cramped and unhygienic living conditions, limited food and healthcare facilities, a lack of phones in order for refugees to be able to contact their families, as well as cases of abuse by both the Bangladeshi Navy and local labourers engaging in extortion. Commodore Chaudhary denied the allegations. He said, "We are taking care of them as our guests," he added. "They are given proper food and access to all the facilities." When Commodore Chaudhary was asked about the whereabouts of the 306 Rohingya already on the island, he said none was available to meet the gathered journalists. As the tour continued beyond the vacant buildings and out into the fields, some signs of life emerged from the swathes of green grass. Hundreds of buffalo and sheep stood grazing, and watching over them was 50-year-old cattle rancher Tajul Haq, who said he had been working on the island for the past 5 years, caring for the buffalo. Tajul Haq said, "I look after around 100 buffalo on behalf of the owner. The island is full of grass, so suitable for buffalo. The land is also very fertile. You can grow anything here." The Bangladeshi government has long promised the United Nations access to the island of Basanchar in order to carry out an official assessment of the long-term safety and sustainability of the island. But the Bangladeshi authorities are still holding the United Nations at bay, leaving the question of whether the land can provide enough food, facilities and livelihood opportunities to support 100,000 people unanswered. The United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees said that with the arrival of 306 refugees, an on-site visit by the United Nations was now even more crucial to assess the conditions for those already living on the island. They said they had submitted their request to the Bangladeshi government but were yet to hear back. Many Rohingya Muslims are also concerned that the island, at just 6 feet above sea level, is extremely vulnerable to cyclones, to monsoon rains and tidal surges. Commodore Chaudhary said during a PowerPoint presentation to journalists that not only had a 14-kilometer-long seawall been constructed to protect the island, but that experts had established the risk of the island being hit by a cyclone as very low. Commodore Chaudhary said, "No severe cyclone eye has hit this area in the last 172 years. He showed off what he said was 120 cyclone shelters capable of withstanding 260 kilometers per hour winds. But contrary to Commodore Chaudhary's claim, there is evidence to suggest two cyclones did in fact track right across or very close to the island of Basanchar in 1991 and in 1997. And it is well documented the damage caused by cyclones frequently occurs many miles from the eye of the storm. Bangladesh experiences an average of more than one cyclonic storm every year, and weather experts said the likelihood of Basanchar being affected in the future was high, and that the topography and low-lying ground meant such storms could cause major flooding, both from excessive rainfall and from coastal storm surges. The isolation of the island of Basanchar is also something the Rohingya Muslims fear. Back on board the Bangladeshi Navy vessel after the Commodore's tour, it was another three-hour rough ride back to the mainland. Nur Hossein, a Rohingya camp resident, who had seen pictures of the island and spoken to Rohingya elders who visited, said, "The houses are good in Basanchar, but it looks like a prison." He said, "In Cox's Bazar, we're living as a community," he added, "but on the island, our freedom would be restricted. We would have to live under Bangladeshi Navy surveillance." For others in the refugee camps, living so close to the border between Bangladesh and their homeland of Myanmar offers some solace. And the option of moving to a remote island feels like a shift even further away from their dreams of returning home. One community elder, who was among 40 or so taken on a tour of the island in September, but who asked not to be identified for fear of retribution, explained the importance of the refugee camps being close to the border with Myanmar. He said, "The Bangladesh government wants us, the elders, to speak publicly in the refugee camps in favor of the island of Basanchar. However, the general population brands us traitors if we speak for relocation," he added. "They are dead against the plans to relocate to the island. It doesn't matter how beautiful the infrastructure is. The Rohingya Muslims feel connected to their roots in Myanmar while staying in Cox's Bazar." Even for Rashida Khatun, the idea of leaving the camps to be reunited with her children is too much of a risk. Because for her, the refugee camps were always temporary, and 3 years on, her aim is still for all of her family to return to Myanmar. She said, "I want my son and my daughter back here." She added, "Why should I go there? Here, Myanmar is close. If we get justice, we shall go back to Myanmar as soon as possible. I will not go to Basanchar."
Food for thought.
Hello, dear listeners, and have a nice day to you all. Let us refresh our minds with a wise statement from the Prophet of Islam to his vicegerent, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon them. O Ali, the most favorable deeds to attain the proximity of God are three. The best worshipper is the one who fulfills the obligatory duties of God properly. The most pious of people is the one who abstains from the forbidden matters. The wealthiest of people is the one who is satisfied with that which God has given.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamate is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Jafar Sobhani. Please stay tuned.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. والصلاة والسلام على خير خلقه وآله الطاهرين.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Praise be to Allah, the Lord of the worlds, and may His peace and blessings be upon the best of His creation, Prophet Muhammad, and his pure progeny. The story of a famous 7th century Muslim scholar, Sakaki, is also very interesting. He began to study at the age of 30. Though his teachers were not at all hopeful of his success, he continued his study with a wonderful zeal and enthusiasm. With a view to ascertain the extent of his intelligence, a teacher once posed the problem of Shafi'i jurisprudence before him. The teacher said, "The Sheikh says that the skin of a dog becomes clean and pure by pounding." Sakaki was supposed to learn this by heart. So he repeated it many times and became ready to recite it when called for. Next day, the teacher asked him to recite the sentence in front of the other students. He stood up at once to say, "The dog said the teacher's skin becomes clean and pure by pounding." Hearing this, everyone, including the teacher, burst into laughter. Yet, the aged pupil's determination was so sound that despite this experience, he did not give up his study, but followed the same course for another 10 years. Of course, due to advancing age, his grasping power was becoming weak day by day. Once he had gone to the forest to memorize his lessons, where he noticed that the drops of rainwater constantly fell on a rock and made marks on that hard stone. He thought over it and told himself, "My heart is not harder than this rock. If drops of knowledge fall on it constantly, like these raindrops, they too would certainly leave imprints on it, at least to some extent." He returned home and began to study with added zeal. At last, as a result of his untiring and continuous efforts and non-stop endeavor, he became a distinguished personality of the literary circles of the Arab world. He authored a book which was, for many years, a textbook in the course of Arabic education. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Ulama's Speech. which was the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Jafar Sobhani. To find out more about this program, log on to our website parstoday.com/en, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
Being here at Mass Ikna has become something of a pleasurable tradition for me. I first participated in the Interfaith Symposium in its inaugural year in 2015, and this is my third time visiting with you. I'm grateful to the convener of the Interfaith Symposium, Karen Danielson, for her long-standing friendship, and over the last 4 years, I have participated in events across Chicago at the Mosque Foundation and at the Universal High School. She and her colleagues have visited my synagogue. Some of these interfaith events we shared with other speakers today. So I'm happy to be with all of you today. So my comments today are in two parts. First, I talk about my relationship as a rabbi and a Jew to Muslims and Palestinians. Second, I point to a pressing concern I have about Jewish-Christian interfaith. Now, there are rabbis whose job it is to do interfaith. They have advanced degrees in the subject. Interfaith is in their job description. It's on their business cards. I am not one of them. The reason why I am here and not them is because of the positions I have taken on Palestine in distinction to theirs. In particular, unlike some of my colleagues, I would never demand that Muslims refrain from speaking their minds and their hearts on Israel-Palestine as a prerequisite for interfaith dialogue with me. I am a rabbi, and I wholeheartedly endorse BDS, the three-part Palestinian call for justice and equality. I say yes to BDS in the first place because it is what the Palestinians have asked of us. I say yes to BDS because until Palestinians are free, neither will the Jews be free. And I'm here to tell you that along with Jewish Voice for Peace, not all Jews support the State of Israel's persecution of Palestinians, and the views I hold are held by hundreds of thousands of other Jews. Now, when you turn outward, away from your religious group, you inevitably turn your back on some of your own, or so some people will feel. And these people may act on their feelings. And as my esteemed interfaith colleagues in the earlier session know, building bridges to other faiths and ethnic or racial groups can mean burning bridges within the faith, losing friends, and even straining family relations. I know. I have experienced all of that. The walls around each of our religions are designed in part to keep them out and us in. And discovering that the best of Jewish values are also Christian and Muslim can be threatening to some people's identity. But my experience teaches me that the rewards of reaching out surpass the risk and the cost. First and foremost, there is the joy and freedom of speaking one's hopes and aspirations honestly and living in alignment with the call for justice. Secondly, for every friend I have lost in the Jewish community, I have made wonderful new friends in other communities such as here, and indeed new friends in the Jewish community. Let me tell you a little bit about my family history as it informs my interfaith work. Over a century ago, my paternal grandfather was orphaned in a white supremacist massacre against Jews in his native Ukraine. 80 years ago, my mother lost her parents when the Nazi state murdered them and 6 million other people for the crime of being born Jews. And in both cases, non-Jews were instrumental in saving their lives. My mother's life was saved through a remarkable operation, a collaboration between Jews and Quakers in my native England. And now, while I carry my grandfather and mother's experience with me, I am blessed that my own political reality is so different to what they experienced as children. After all, I am a white middle-class Jew in America. And so in previous years, I attended Mass Ikna to stand in solidarity with the religious community whose political reality is closer to that of my grandparents than my own. A community with many first-generation immigrants who are targeted by the government and others on account of their skin color, race, or religion. This year, however, is different. Yes, I am here in solidarity, but this year, I have skin in the game too, Jewish skin. You see, in the past year of 2019, something fundamental changed for me. Interfaith has become more complicated and at the same time more urgent. Interfaith is such a compelling idea in no small part because of the perception in society that religion is divisive. In response, interfaith makes the bold claim that our particular religious traditions need not drive us apart, but actually draw us closer to each other. We must scale the world's walls around our own religions to build bridges with others. And when we cross those bridges, we need to have honest conversation and ask open-ended questions with an open heart and truly address our concerns to bring ourselves to the conversation. Pittsburgh, Poway, Jersey City. Friends, 2019 brought the unwelcome, unprecedented phenomenon of the periodic murder of Jews in America every few months. It exposed the ugly undercurrent of anti-Semitism, not just in areas where hatred of minorities is perhaps commonplace, but also in genteel suburbia and the big cities. And as we come to the end of 2019, the good intentions and positivity of past interfaith gatherings will no longer suffice. After years of building goodwill and collaborating in so many beautiful ways, the time has come in this relationship to risk some honesty. And this is my honest talk. The conversations at Jewish Hanukkah celebrations this year turned to how safe it is to publicly identify as a Jew. A few years ago, such fears would have been deemed irrational. Not anymore. And as a Jew, I am afraid. And as a Jew, I know what it is to be in the religious majority. I have had that experience. I was an Israeli Jew for 20 years. I grew up in a country where Jewish concerns were self-evident and those of others were not well represented. I grew up in a country where the evidence of the Nakba was all around me, but there was no narrative, no awareness for the majority Jews to make moral or emotional sense of it. And so, the Palestinian past was a ghost and the Palestinian present was irrelevant or a threat. It was only when I came here and joined the American Jewish community that I saw the fundamental injustice of the Israeli system with regard to the Palestinians. Only when I became a religious minority in a Christian majority country was I able to see Israel in perspective. Some of you who came from Muslim majority countries and are now a religious minority as American Muslims may have had a similar reassessment of how you see your home countries. So where does the interfaith community go from here? The bottom line is that even as interfaith relations are so important, I can no longer engage in them with blind trust in the goodwill of my counterparts. Back in April 2019, a religious man prayed hateful words on Good Friday. A week later, he took the life of a Jew in synagogue on a holy day as she prayed to God. The murderer said, "I learned that it was right to kill Jews in church." Not that his church or any church preached violence against Jews, far from it. But words do matter. What we say in our houses of worship at elevated moments of emotion on sacred days and in deep moments of prayer truly matter. Words are the stuff of religion, holy writ, scripture, liturgy, prayer, sermon, and we need to get it right. So, henceforth, I will ask my interfaith partners, when you pray, how do you speak of the Jews? And perhaps I have now come to the same place as the organizers of this wonderful interfaith symposium. Namely, not all interfaith partners are equally welcome. There have to be some basic standards for engagement. So going forward, I will ask direct questions and listen carefully to the answers. Perhaps that is what it means to be Jewish. Perhaps that is what it means to be a religious minority. Thank you.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
In the United States, the role of scientific research in public policy is clearly on the ballot in the 3rd of November presidential election. Some Republicans have sought to undermine the research showing human-caused climate change since long